Session number 26590, General Wilhelm Muller, Reel 12. A very noisy development on the microphone.
You were discussing some informal arrangements that were made with the Swedes to improve the use of radar and air defence in general. What sort of arrangements did you have with Denmark to consolidate cover over the Baltic?
No, there was no similar, not in the beginning. This has to do with that arrangement fairly short after the war, when we made the this was purely military at that time, and I may have said last time that it really originated by the commanding officer of the area where I was chief of staff. And his colleague in Göteborg, they knew each other. And the fact was that Swedes had no radar, and we had the radar, which we brought along with us from the Tactical Air Force. And so we arranged then, I may be repeating myself, but we arranged then that they would borrow land or whatever on a pure personal basis, land our radar, it was on the trailer, of course, go down to the Säve, which is the Air Force station outside Göteborg, and they would practice while we sort of attacked into their area. And then for the next 2 days of the week, or 3 days of the week, they had it 2 days, we took it back and they flew against us. So we had people down there training them on this radar and so on. Well, they got their own radar, so it faded out in that sense. But the cooperation was on the move. But it was too much on the Swedish side, you can say, they with their strong neutrality sort of thing. It was more sensitive than with us, although it was still kept within the area of the personal relationship, really. So it was necessary, and particularly when NATO started developing, the Swedes wanted, it was necessary to have more formal arrangements. And then it was then that it was moved into the rescue area. And that brought the Danes in, but not before that.
Did the Danes have radar at that time, or were they having to borrow yours?
No, the Danes didn't do anything. That was also, we didn't have the same connection. It wasn't the same personal thing, and it wasn't really there wasn't really a question about it. It was really because this fellow in Göteborg saw an opportunity, and we arranged it on a very simple, practical basis, and it worked wonderful.
Was there ever any sort of contact with the Finns with regard to air defence in the war?
No, not certainly not. We are talking of that time, but even later there was no connection there.
You were mentioning that it was the Oslo area air defence. How far did the Oslo area air defence extend? What were its boundaries?
Well, of course, when we got into NATO, and particularly when we got the proper radar stations, they had plenty of capacity. And the radar station that we built, say, down at Mockeray, South Coast, a little further down, outlet of the Oslofjord and so on, they would take how much? 200 miles, 250 miles, depending on what altitude you're talking about, really. They go, as you know, in a kind of a curved beam. So when you get off, they leave the sea and don't pick up low down. But they have a fire range if you start getting a little higher up. But they were powerful radar stations. They are part. They're still moving. An amazing piece of equipment, still moving.
And this was introduced later on after NATO or before NATO?
No, this was after NATO. And after they came in too on the mutual aid program. That was so. It was American equipment that came in. That, but this is later, of course. And then we had radar north too, which could see far into Finland. Kola Peninsula and that sort of thing. Yes.
What was your view of the state of the Russian air defence at that time? Did you have any information about what they could do and what they could see with their systems?
Well, I might have had it at that time, but I can't remember it today that we had. No, I didn't. The, of course, we had the intelligence people. We had the Air Force intelligence people. They were also part of the joint intelligence people. And they had a lot of information on this, I'm sure. And within NATO area, this was material that was exchanged. So I would say that there was a lot of information about how the capacity and capability and so on. But I can't say that I remember particularly that I wasn't that involved. With their chief of staff was head of the Air Force and so on. It really was the operational part wasn't that close to my to follow it on the pulse, if you'll say it that way. Although I was part of where to put it and that sort of thing, but of course the intelligent people, they have a lot of other ways and sources to evaluate the capabilities.
Was it felt generally that there was a real threat to Oslo, that an enemy might attempt a preemptive attack on the centre of the Norwegian government and Norwegian defence? Was that considered a possibility in these early days, say up to 1949?
Oh yes. Yes, it was, of course, it was a period before NATO when, you know, how is the world developing? And
it's a fluid period, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was an area where so on, it was for us an area whether we should join NATO or not, of course. And we had, it was a political question, of course. And although in Norway, the idea established itself, I think, much so, partly by our experience from the war, and which differed very much from the Swedes. And then there was a strong feeling that the Nordic countries should try to establish something between themselves.
As an alternative to NATO?
Yes, you can say that, or at least an independent area. We would never be as powerful as on, but we could still. And this is actually to follow the neutrality line of Sweden. We had given up the sort of neutrality, really, but it was an endeavor, or at least a try, to see if there was any future, any vision that you could see within Nordic cooperation outside NATO. And I wasn't part of that discussion, really, but I know a fair amount about it, I dare say. And it came to the conclusion, of course, that while Sweden would not leave their strict neutrality basis, we felt that resources within the Scandinavian area wouldn't at all measure up to requirements. And that for us, it was no other way than to hang on to NATO. And it established us, of course, and the ties that we knew from the war. So it wasn't so on. But it was, I wouldn't call it a political maneuvering and so on. It was the reality behind the discussion. And the reality came out that Sweden chooses their way and we choose the other way. And the Danes choose the same as we did. So it didn't become anything of that. This didn't bar the fact that there went on considerable feelings that the Nordic countries must have a lot in common. And so even if we were in NATO and they were on, there were a lot to talk about in so many ways of society requirements and also defense things and all. But the lines were pretty strict, and in particular, this, from the Swedish point of view, they were very stern that breakage of anything that could throw a shadow on their really will to stay neutral was jeopardized by anything, which led to that. Although I personally, as head of the Air Force, well before that, as the chief of staff in the Air Force too, had contacts in Sweden. I had people I talked with, and so on. But we were quite aware on both parts that we mustn't make it difficult for the politicians to. We mustn't, destroy the firm basis on which we understood our situation. But that was all right. We could still talk. We could exchange personal views and that sort of thing. But we didn't really sort of talk about troops and forces and that sort of thing.
You didn't go into the details.
Although to some extent you would say that you could come in. We had, for example, a support role for American bombers,
yes,
that might come back after raids in the Baltic area. There was a recovery. There was a support job, which would mean, what you call a swamping the radars on the other side, which is part of penetration techniques. And it was also the recovery phase of things. And this, of course, entailed then, what if we, to get into Leningrad, for example, the shortest way would be to fly across the Swedish area. Now, if you fly across the Swedish area, then they are staying neutral. Will they resist, will they so on? I mean, you can talk, you can't get down to say what is the order of battle, but you,
yes,
can still talk about what is the understanding about how would you look upon that in such and such circumstances. And we did talk that way. It really meant a lot of confidence and faith, but it didn't. Our conditions didn't. We thought, I think both parties thought, that to understand each other were pretty important.
And what was the Swedish view on that? Would they have condoned or tolerated Norwegian aircraft flying over their airspace to Leningrad or not? What did they say?
Well, sitting back a long time ago and so on, I'll say that my understanding really from this was, I can name him, General Westring. He was a very fine, very, very fine Swedish chief of staff. He had my opposite number before I was head of the Air Force. Mm. And we had a good, very good relationship and so on. And he sort of, I can't remember in detail, but to take the understanding of it, that, wouldn't it be rather stupid to preempt ourselves completely if something worse to Sweden could happen afterwards? That sort of thing. In other words, to shoot at us would probably be to waste their things, wouldn't it be to preempt us when worse things were in store, was a reasonable attitude, I would say.
did you discuss the possibility of the Swedes' behaviour in the event of Russian aircraft crossing their airspace?
Oh yes, there was no doubt.
They'd be resisted.
Yeah, but the only thing is, and here again was a question of preempting, mm-hmm, that if it was obvious that the purpose of whatever came from that side wasn't designated for Sweden, but it had purposes of a different nature, hitting targets far away for one thing, or aircraft carriers or whatever, that might be the obvious threat to the Russians, then the question of preempting, of course, will then again come up.
Yes.
This doesn't mean that I would say that they said that we let them fly. They didn't say that, but you could sense that sort of consideration was in their mind. And I don't. I mean, that's what's a natural thing. If they are neutral, they try to stay neutral. But that's.
Well, in theory, the doctrine of neutrality requires you to resist incursions by all foreign forces, no matter who they are or where they're going.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's certainly the line the Swiss took during the Second World War.
Yes. Well, you know, it's a little hard to forget that the Swedes let German troops go through Sweden up to during our war. They did.
Yes.
They did, as you know.
It's a slightly less strict idea of neutrality than the Swiss.
Hmm?
It's a less strict idea of neutrality than the Swiss.
Yeah, yeah.
You're mentioning that there might be support for American bombers heading down the border towards Leningrad. Would that have involved, in effect, acting as a sort of escort? Would that have involved Norwegian fighters acting as an escort?
Well, not directly escort, but supporting. It could be either in the escort way, but I would say rather, you know, when you get to distances that, and you think of the airplane we had, and you also think of endurance and time, you get into a lot of practicalities in this game. So what should we do, and what could other people do, and that sort of thing. We had the same with in England with the American bombers. We could follow them that long, but we couldn't follow them any longer. And we could recover them that far out, but we couldn't go further because simply we didn't have the range. So it was a tricky thing it's part of the air tactics, you know.
When it comes to air tactics, when it comes to the air defence of the Oslo area, was the idea that the fighters would try and intercept enemy aircraft at the maximum distance from their presumed targets, and that the immediate defence would be done by gun or missile batteries, or were you going to have your interceptors integrated with guns and missiles over the target area? What sort of ideas did you have about that?
Well, that was really the main reason for integrating the Air Force and the gunners altogether. Well, it was thought that way.
Yes.
I was in America at that time, so I wasn't part of that discussion. But when the idea came up about the Nike as a defense line throughout Europe, all the way up, then it was felt that this missile system, being a high altitude missile system, and the airplanes had to be integrated so that they came under the same air defense control system, etc., etc. And that was really the basis for the integration. Now, the anti-aircraft people were a sort of entity by themselves. And they had, of course, the artillery pieces before, and they also have the small artillery, the 20mm, and the smaller things, 40mm. And the lower one, and so the idea was that if you amalgamate, if you fuse them or integrate them, you've got to take the whole lot. You can't take just the Nike missiles. Of course, we had to give up the guns in order to, otherwise their budget would breach. So the 88mm and so on, they had to go out. In order to get the Nike. So when you got those airplane, you also got the smaller one, the low defense weapons. And that, of course, brought in a lot of people with a professional sort of environment on the ground, which was really, you can say, quite a problem. I think that if you hadn't had that, the process would have been easier at the time. But it was a heavy process, I must say. I inherited it, because when I got back to Norway, I became chief of staff. So, and then the decision was made on this. But you asked whether it was really necessary. Well, they didn't do it in America. You had the RAF regiment in a very specific relationship. You had the entity of the RAF regiment. You didn't do it integration. With the Bormark, how did you do it with the, with, no, not the Bormark, with the, the system you had, which the Swedes also had. Well, the weapon, the equivalent to the Nike and so on.
We had a thing called the Bloodhound.
Yeah, the Bloodhound. That was how Bormark was the competitor to the Nike. I remember at that time. It didn't come off. I don't think you didn't integrate that, did you? No, you didn't.
Well, during the war, I think we had integrated command.
Integrated command. Yeah.
We had anti-aircraft command led by General Pyle, dealt with training, administration, personnel matters, things like that. But I think for operational purposes, all the anti-aircraft effort and fighters came under a sector command.
Yeah.
With a controller of some sort.
Yeah, but they still belong, like the Rapier in your system today, that's an army, that's an army. That's an
well,
army.
Well, Rapier is Royal Air Force.
Is it?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, it's, so, but the necessity for integration, I would say that, to my mind, it could be solved different too, if you wanted it that way. But anyway, it was felt that this was, at the time, it was General Motzfeldt who was in head that time, and he wanted the Nike, and there was no doubt in his mind on that. And just as sure, he had to also take the small arms for the low altitude. Of course, we never got the Hawk. The Hawk would have been a sort of in between.
Yes.
But it stopped with the Nike. It was pure money that stopped it. It would cost that much. Hawk was a fairly people-consuming system. People intensity, isn't that what they
intensity.
Yes. System. And we had to refrain from that, although everybody recognized that the Hawk system was a good system. But I remember once when we talked about Hawk, and I was in America, and even a fellow who was very much of a Hawk enthusiast and so on, he said, well, you take Hawk, but where are you going to put it? I've been looking at your airports and the mountains around them and all that sort of thing. How do you think they're going to be useful to justify the usefulness as a system? And he figured that there wasn't many places, like Andøya would be fine, but otherwise there wasn't many places that they weren't screened by mountains or things like that.
You do have a very specific terrain to think about.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. So it wasn't all clear that Hawk was. It was a brilliant system, no doubt, but whether it would fit in as well with the potential that it had as a system was a different thing. Well, anyway, we didn't get it. We couldn't afford it.
Another aspect of air defence, which in Britain in wartime was partly integrated, was the question of civil defence, of providing warning to the civilian population of an air raid, and also providing them with protection in the way of shelters. What was the policy with regard to that?
Well, it wasn't our. It was the air defence system, because we had the command points, like outside Oslo here, in Trondheim and Bodø. And they had links in to us, but they did their own thing. We had no responsibility directly in that, but the warning and that sort of thing was their part. And the build-up of the actual command post and so on, they had their own setting where they could follow all the things. They were part of the system, but they had their own people to do whatever was required.
So would your role have been confined to providing them with information on which they could face a warning?
And be part of the judgment, the general judgment of the situation and that sort of thing, yeah. But they had to, any executive sort of things, well, their own business.
But you're mentioning the possibility of American aircraft carriers being out at sea, the Norwegian Sea. When did that seem to become a possibility or a probability that carrier groups would appear to the west of the Norwegian coast in the shell operation?
Hard to say. It developed. The first big exercise we had, I was at Gardermoen, had the air station at Gardermoen at that time. It was as early as 48, 49, I would think. We had a big exercise called Main Brace, where you had American carriers, British too, right up to in the North Sea between Iceland and Norway. Now, of course, from a Russian point of view, they posed a tremendous threat. So they followed them pretty close from both underwater protection and submarines and that sort of thing, and also from the air. So they certainly became a, you can say, a disturbing factor in the thing. But otherwise, they were there, like the Russians, they were there too. And as it developed, Russians got there later, as you know, but they built up a formidable system.
What would the carrier groups have been attacking? Would they have been going for Russian bases like Murmansk and Archangel and over that area around the Kola Peninsula and White Sea? Or would their role have been primarily one of defending Norwegian airspace and dealing with target opportunity? Did you have any idea about that?
Well, it was part of the retaliatory forces. So they would be used that way,
yes.
The same way as the bombers would be used. I would say they would be part of that, yes. And for that reason, of course, they were tremendously worthwhile targets from Russian point of view. They had a tremendous capability, those carriers.
They carried a lot of aircraft, didn't they?
Yes. I was on board one during that exercise, Main Brace.
Yes.
And I was on board a British ship too. That was my carrier. It was a naval thing, fairly big. And it was in the to the wardroom. This one was moving around. It was also going into Sweden, going down to Denmark. Came up to Norway. It was part of a visit, And there was a thing that they said that, remember, they said that when you are in Norway, all the Vikings were Norwegians. Of course, when you come to Sweden, you must acknowledge there were Swedish Vikings too. This is to your officers.
Yes.
Of course, the Danes claim that most of them came down there. That's where, anyway, that's where, and so on. But of course, so you just got to remember what relationship in the Scandinavian area. I like that.
Well, the Royal Navy has to show some tact. How was the staff at the Oslo area organised? When you were chief of staff, what sort of departments did you have to carry out the normal business?
Well, of course, we had a command system too,
yes.
To take that first. You know, we had a headquarters system, and then you have. So we had in the beginning. We had four command systems. We had one covering the eastern area, and one with the bases in Stavanger covering that part of Norway, going down the North Sea as well, that direction. And then we had Trondheim, and then we had Bodø. So you had all these, and Bodø, of course, and all these had some airfields, depending on where you were. You operated from those. Bodø, of course, had extensions further north, Bardufoss, Andøya, but there were the command center was in Bodø. When it comes to the headquarters itself, here in Oslo, where I was then. Then we had the traditional way. We had the personnel, the logistic, the operational, and the economy. Yeah, I mean,
like the sort of regular military structure.
Regular military structure. And sometimes you could wonder whether that was the best. But then the army had about the same, the navy had about the same, and the way we cooperated with the defense ministry was, you can almost say.